Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour has written a very interesting article in the Harvard Business Review, What So Many People Don't Get About the U.S. Working Class. Professor Joan Williams is with us, and she writes a lot of things that are well worth paying attention to. Class trumps gender, and it is driving American politics. Democrats, if they want to regain their majorities, need to remember five major points. We'll talk about those points. She'll look at some of the incredible statistics that came from this election, the number of white working class women who voted for Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton by a whopping 28-point margin, 62-34%. If they had split 50-50, she would have won. We will talk about that. We'll talk about white working class resenting professionals but admiring the rich. We will talk about how difficult it has been for white working class men to find jobs that pay them decent wages and how getting a good paycheck is very important to everybody, but this group feels really left out of being able to get family-supporting jobs. We'll talk about her family because sometimes we can notice a great deal about what's going on in the country by looking at people in our family. She writes some interesting things about her father-in-law who grew up eating blood soup. And how he had to work to find himself and his family in the middle class. Our guest is Professor Joan Williams, a distinguished professor of law and founding director of the Center of Work-Life Law at the University of California, Hastings College of Law. The New York Times has described her as someone approaching rock star status for her academic work. She's received many awards, and she is the author or co-author of over 90 academic articles and book chapters, along with 8 books, including What Works for Women at Work, 4 Patterns Every Woman Should Know. I think this will generate a lot of interest among you, our listeners. Here's our phone number whenever you'd like to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Professor Joan Williams, thanks so much for being with us. Hi.
Delighted to be here, Kathleen.
Yeah, it's a great article. You say the only thing that surprised you about Donald Trump is your friend's astonishment at his success. What's driving it really is the class culture gap. And evidently, a lot of us don't understand that gap.
Unfortunately not. The only reason I understand it is that I come from an upper-middle-class family and married into a blue-collar family. White workers are really, really different from, I live in San Francisco, and sort of you're a garden variety progressive in San Francisco, and they don't understand, these groups don't understand each other. For example, professionals were completely aghast that so many white working class people voted for Trump, despite the fact that in the progressives' eyes, this guy's just a rich guy who is ripping them off.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of resentment among the white working class of professionals, and there's a lot of admiration for the rich. That's because professionals just live very, very different lives than people in the working class do. They go to Dunkin' Donuts for their coffee, and in San Francisco, we wouldn't even be caught dead in Starbucks. We need artisanal coffee.
Oh, my gosh, do you really?
Yeah, it's been poured, it's, you know, very slowly at $6 a cup.
Ooh.
Well, they think that's kind of crazy. Their attitude is towards good food is simple food and lots of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like a very simple thing that you would have different food traditions, but it triggers really something. It stands for something very deep, which is that among the, what I call the upper middle class, I call them actually the professional managerial elite, among the likes of, among my crowd, we're focused on self-development, we're focused on self-actualization, on developing our skills and our ourselves to the maximum extent possible. And the white working class traditionally has been focused not on that. After all, that's not available to them. Why would they focus on that? How painful would that be? But they're focused really more on self-discipline and upholding traditions. They're much more focused on family as opposed to work. They think that the professional managerial elite is bizarrely focused on work. And in some ways, you know, they're kind of right.
Right.
They are. And so I just think that the professional managerial upper class, middle class people can learn a lot about America by learning about the white working class, and frankly, they can learn a lot about themselves too.
Mm-hmm. So it understands. You talk about Hillary Clinton in the article, and you describe this Hillary Clinton to people in the white working class epitomized the dorky arrogance and smugness of the professional elite, the pantsuits, the arrogance, the email server, the smugness of the basket of deplorables. Her mere presence rubs it in, you write, that even women from her class can treat working class men with disrespect.
Well, I mean, I do think that the upper middle class people treat the white working class with tremendous disrespect. I mean, I just think of this in terms of... you think in the 30s, where the Works Progress Administration, you probably have them in Wisconsin. We certainly do here in San Francisco. These murals that basically idealize blue collar life and blue collar men. And then around 1970, all that changed. One big change was All in the Family, where Archie Bunker all of a sudden stood in for somebody who was racist, sexist, know nothing, idiot. And his college-going son-in-law was really depicted very, very positively. You think of Homer Simpson. Homer Simpson is works at a nuclear power plant, doing his best to trash the environment, and he's, you know, stupid, fat, alcoholic. These are not very flattering portraits. All in the Family was actually produced by Norman Lear, who was at the center of progressives in this country, went on to found People for the American Way. And so very sharply after 1970, upper middle class people began to openly make fun of lower middle class people. And, you know, a lot of the epithets, the kind of epithets that we would not be caught dead using in the race context, similar epithets are used all the time in the class context. Fraternities across the country have trailer trash parties. I mean, this is calling fellow citizens garbage.
Mm-hmm.
And we do it very openly. It's kind of funny. It's not actually funny. So I mean, as we all know, women professionals can get away with a lot less than male professionals. And that was going on with Hillary Clinton in spades. She couldn't get away with a lot of stuff that Bill Clinton could get away with. And that's because if you think about it, when you think about a man to be reckoned with, there's a choice. There's two choices. You can be a good man. That's one option. That's the President Barack Obama option. Or you can be a real man. And that's the President Donald Trump option, right? But you can be either one. But if you're a woman, there's only one option. You can be a good woman, in which case, by the way, you're modest, self-effacing, and nice. That's what social psychology studies show that the good woman is seen as. But then you're not presidential material, are you? Or you can be an assertive and ambitious woman, and then you're not a good woman. And then... what do we, you know, so lock her up. She's not a good woman. And so one of the other messages of the election is the glass ceiling, you know, it really has proved much harder than we thought it was. And women have made very little progress. White men still privileged white men still run virtually every corporation, the government, virtually of the universities still run basically everything. So we did see very profound messages about why that's true in the election.
Mm-hmm.
White women don't hang together, never have, probably never will. They often put their class interests or other or family's interests or any of 400,000 interests above their own self-interest. And why is that? Because to be a good woman, again, going back to these social psychology studies, it's to be selfless. Well, they were.
Mm-hmm. So let's look at white working class women for a moment. You talked about the Donald Trump, Barack Obama choice is a real man or a good man. When it came to these numbers, which are astounding, white working class women voting for Trump over Clinton by 28-point margin, and that was really the difference in the election. If you remind us, they had split 50-50, she would have won. So what are the values of working class women? And if you're going to be a real man or a good man, what about if you're a white working class woman, you are either a what woman or a what woman?
Well, I mean, many white working class women are family women. That's what they are. They're women who identify very, they may identify with work, but they identify very deeply with family. The bottom line with respect to white working class women and Hillary Clinton is that Hillary Clinton, I mean, she would have been a really good president. She was not a very good campaigner at all. She's great on policy. She's pretty poor on politics. And so putting at the center of her campaign the glass ceiling, well, wait a minute. Let's run that through their heads, our heads. What does the glass ceiling mean? It's a metaphor that says that privileged women should be able to get the jobs that are now held by privileged men. Why should the working class care? They don't care. That's what the glass ceiling meant for them. It meant that Hillary, who graduated from Yale Law School, could become president. One of the things that she didn't really properly exploit, although, again, it would have been hard for her to do that. It is very hard as a professional woman, that one of the ways that working class women do identify with more privileged women is sexual harassment. But Hillary Clinton's campaign was just really profoundly class clueless in a lot of ways. She just wanted to keep the topic as, I'm super qualified, I'm going to break the glass ceiling, Donald Trump is not qualified. This was not a message that was designed to connect to the white working class. And when Bill Clinton and others wanted to go out and go to Michigan and go to some of these other swing states, the campaign finally let them go, but it told Bill Clinton not to talk about the blue-collar issues that he is so good at talking about, because they wanted to go back to, we're going to break the glass ceiling, Trump is not qualified. This was a really bad mistake.
Right. So what were the working-class values that Donald Trump tapped into so successfully?
You know, in some ways I wouldn't use that word values because, I mean, kind of a leap of the imagination to think of Donald Trump in the same sentence as moral values. But I think what Donald Trump is a master at tapping into working class anger against elites, that's for sure. And that's one of the things he did. He also is, he is an anger against tapping into coded racism, as we all saw. But the other thing is that Donald Trump took seriously for the first time in about 40 years the need to create good middle-class jobs for middle-class people. That is not something the Democrats have spent very much time talking about since they there was the New Deal coalition put blue-collar jobs and blue-collar concerns at the center of Democratic politics. Then, with McGovern around 1970, Democratic politics shifted to cultural issues, shifted to the issues I've worked my entire life on, gender, race, environmentalism, those kinds of things. And suddenly, blue-collar issues were not the center. Trump put them back there. And I personally believe, as a progressive, that's where they should be, giving people of all working class people of all races good, solid jobs that allow them to attain settled working middle class life. I think that's a central agenda that we have too long overlooked.
The temptation, you write, to write off blue-collar resentment as racism. Have the Democrats said a lot of that, and why is that something that they need to avoid?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's Democrats specifically. I think that's really all progressives, as the instinct is to write off the white working class as racist, sexist, beneath our notice. And you know what? Americans are racist and sexist. The style of racism is quite different in the white working class than it is in white elites. But it's very well documented that there's a lot of racism in both groups. And there's a really interesting study that shows that the groups who are several groups who are more racist, as measured by the implicit association test, than working class whites are MBAs and doctors and college grads. The racism is quite different. I mean, in the privileged people, we pride ourselves on our merit. And so we stereotype blacks as lacking in merit. So, for example, one study showed that gave people identical resumes, one with the name Greg at the top and one with the name Jamal, and found that Jamal needed 8 additional years of experience in order to get the same number of callbacks as Greg. That's typical racism in the professional context. Blacks are lack merit. The white working class places its really hangs its identity on morality. And so racism in that context stereotypes blacks as more lacking in morality than whites. Now, I'm not defending either kind of racism, and I'm not saying white people aren't racist. All are true. That's true. White people are racist. On the other hand, for privileged white people to be looking at less privileged white people, making fun of them, saying, I'm not going to listen to your legitimate economic concerns because you are racist, excuse me, there's something off there.
Mm-hmm.
You think they're not racist?
Right. Let's talk before we go to phone calls, and many of them are coming in, more about this, as I don't fully understand this. I do in a bit because my dad was a working class guy. He didn't go to college, you know, worked very, very hard, but it was after World War II, and he was benefiting from how the economy was doing in those days, so mom working part-time, and he had this thing about the rich as well. You know, it was his dream his whole life to have a Cadillac.
Yes,
and people
exactly.
Who were really well, he would kind of admire them in a way that,
yes,
I never fully understood. But you write about this in your piece of the white working class admiring the rich. Where does that come from? And why would you, the people who teach your children, the professionals, and some of them are teachers and people who are helping your children's life, if not your life, why wouldn't you admire those people instead of those who live in gilded gold towers?
It has to do with a class culture gap. Professionals are, number one, they live very different lives. They have very different values. They talk very different way. The role of talk in upper middle class life is very different than it is among the working class. And also, working class people have a lot of interactions with professionals. The teachers who, you know, berate the white working class for not reading enough to their children. Move on from colleges, because a lot of these people don't go to college. After all, 71% of Americans don't graduate from college. But doctors who may talk down and be very condescending to working class people. So white workers often have very negative interactions with professionals and think they're really stuck up. When it comes to the rich, you're in fantasy land. These folks never meet the rich, right? All that what they know about the rich is The Apprentice and Lifetime of the Rich and Famous. And those two are really good examples, because those, particularly think of Lifetime of the Rich and Famous, they often highlight people who grew up in very, very modest circumstances who now are extremely wealthy, and they have the tastes that they developed in their youth. That's what my crowd actually would call bad taste, right? But that's the fantasy of being able to live my life with my values and my food just with more money. And that's why the working class really admires the rich. And the other thing is they don't want to become an anthropologist. They want to own their own business and be independent and work for themselves. They want to be rich. They don't want to be professionals.
Professor Joan Williams is our guest this hour. She's a distinguished professor of law, founding director of the Center of Work-Life Law at the University of California Hastings College of Law. Wrote a very interesting piece that appears in the Harvard Business Review. We have it on our Facebook page. It's well worth reading. And that page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. Let's go first to a Facebook comment for you, Professor. This resentment is no accident, Melissa writes. It has been meticulously cultivated. Also, to those who claim political correctness fatigue, I ask, when did common decency become political correctness? I was born and bred of the white working class. Common decency used to be a tightly held value. This division has been planted, cultivated, and pruned like a prize rose bush while the wealthy lick their chops.
You know, that's true. That's true. It has been very, very, far be it from me to say the Koch brothers and big money has not cultivated a lot of the extreme lack of common courtesy in political discourse and luring, people towards an ideology that I don't find very attractive, and yet people in the white working class are not stupid, and they're not just ignorant people blindly following the lure of the smart people who are tricking them. I think that it really deserves us to talk first of all of 71% of people in this country who aren't college grads to think about them that way, and I don't think they are. Many of them are just as smart as me. They just led different lives and had different opportunities. So, yes, there's been manipulation of racism, and there's been manipulation of resentment against professionals, professionals also have played into those hands in a way that I find deeply disturbing and needs to stop.
Ralph, our first caller. Hi, Ralph.
Hi, how you doing? I appreciate what your guest is saying, and I also will take a little umbrage or give you a little pushback on it. I think it's just oversimplified. I think I grew up squarely in the working class and proceeded to go to school and work hard and become one of those elitist professionals that everyone seems to get down on these days. And I find it a little bit diminishing to people to categorize them in these sort of easy marketing soundbite types, you know, $6 coffee versus salt of the earth folks or whatever. The bottom line is, I think there are people that care about others and care about community and care about the future. And I think there are those that don't. And I think that, by and large, you find those on both ends of the so-called elitist spectrum. But I think that's what's happened is that as the world has changed and moved on, a lot of the working class people, instead of getting on with things and improving themselves and getting back to school and changing jobs, they've become resentful and they feel entitled to a job that isn't going to exist anymore. It's not the Chinese fault and it's not the Mexicans' fault. And it's not anybody else's fault. It's the fact that that job just doesn't exist and they haven't taken up the gumption to get on with it and improve themselves.
Interesting point. Professor Williams.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually the single most common comment that I have of the over 600 comments on my article. This is exactly the most common comment. And I think that, hats off to Ralph, what you've done, and you're what I call a class migrant. You've really gone from one class to a different class, and that's an amazing accomplishment. But I think to what the problem lies with the message from progressives for many, many years, and Obama is part of this, to say that if you're ambitious and if you want a solid life, you should go and graduate from college. And the fact is, that's an illusion. 71% of Americans don't graduate from college. And to say you're really asking to be a second-class citizen unless you graduate from college, which is not what you're saying, but I think is often the message that accompanies what you're saying, I think that's insulting, and I think it's unrealistic. All Americans aren't going to graduate from college, partly because we need a lot of these jobs that are not college jobs that college-educated people take, and partly because we're just not going to spend the money. You know, we've been talking that way since 1970, and we are not going to do it. And so I do think that there's a lot of nostalgia for blue-collar jobs that are not coming back. But I also think that we need an industrial policy that says, here is how we take and leverage technology to upskill some of these service jobs in a way that makes them valuable enough to lead to a modest middle-class life. There's a very, very documented lack of mid-range skill workers in the United States, and that's because we, the progressives and elites, have been so obsessed with college. I've been a professor for nearly 40 years. I value education. I think it's very important. I don't think it's the answer for everybody, mm-hmm. and I think that we have been pretending that it is.
Spend just a little time talking about your father-in-law. You describe him so vividly at the beginning of your article, and I wanted to hear about his life and also why it is that he never thought, because it seems to me, or at least from what I've read and heard from a lot of people, that unions were very important in getting good family-paying jobs for a lot of American workers for a number of years. But your father-in-law seems to have discounted unions. I want to talk about their rise and fall and his skepticism toward unions, which may have benefited him.
Yeah, so shocking, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So shocking. You know, I was just reading this morning a paper by a brilliant young colleague of mine named Vina Dubal, who has written the history of taxi workers in San Francisco.
Mm.
And here's what happened in San Francisco, and I'll tie it back to the question that you asked. Taxi work in the beginning of the 20th century was exploited, low wage, long hours, terrible work. And then through a lot of union organizing, it became a very solid middle-class living. And then what happened is the union, complicated story, I'll simplify it, though. The union of the larger really was, in some ways, got in bed with the largest of the cab companies and began to really lose touch with the workers. In the meantime, of course, there was a lot of anti-union activism. This has been incredibly important to people on the right and incredibly effective. And gradually, the union was gutted. But the most shocking part of the story is that Gavin Newsom, a progressive mayor in San Francisco, made several decisions. First of all, he decided to sell taxi medallions for $250,000 to raise money for the city. So all of these working class guys, many of them immigrants, paid $200,000. And then Gavin Newsom decided that Uber and Lyft and all the rest of them were completely awesome, and he allowed those companies to operate with immunity to all of the regulation that the taxi cab companies were having. And so he basically destroyed the value of their taxi medallions. This is one of the most progressive guys in California. I have a deep admiration for Gavin Newsom. But in terms of giving unions the kind of support that they actually needed to survive, the Democrats have often been missing in action.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ralph, for your call. Let's go to Mike in La Crosse. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to thank you for what you've been saying. You're the first person I have heard that seems to understand what's going on. I wanted to expound just a little bit. For a working-class white male, you are less likely to be able to go to college. You are less likely, if you get divorced, to get custody of your children. You're less likely to be able to get help from a social agency, yet you run around with professional elites talking about male-white privilege all the time. Well, that's a very select group. That's not most working-class white males. And it's, yeah, there's a lot of resentment out there.
Joan.
Yeah, Mike, I mean, sad but true. You know, I think that I mean, keep in mind, I've been a professional feminist for 40 years, and so I've done a lot of talking about male privilege, and I think male privilege is is really out there. But I think a lot of the times that we're talking about the professional managerial elite men who have a tremendous amount of privilege and still have an absolute stranglehold on the wealth and power in this country. And I do think, you know, it is complicated, but I think that we need to enter. I think the idea of abandoning identity politics is frankly nuts. I mean, politics is as much about George Bush's identity as it is about bell hooks' identity. We can't abandon identity politics, but we do need to expand identity politics to include class. By including class, I don't mean just talking about the poor. I mean, include class is one of the central social forces that frames people's lives and helps them make sense of their lives. And we haven't done that effectively. And if we did, we would be talking and be able to connect more with guys like Mike. And he also points out things that are, you know, there are very, very important, concrete, material reasons why what working class people don't, as particularly working class guys, don't go to college. Their choice is not to get into Harvard. The choice is to get into a much lower ranked local school where they may end up with huge debts, not being able to pay their child support and not making more than many college grants. And so I think when the elite talks about going to college, they think, oh, well, if I hadn't graduated from Stanford, my life would have been so different. That's not the college that many working class people have access to.
That's a good point. Thanks, Mike, for the call. Molly sends this email. I grew up in a blue-collar working class family. I'm intimately familiar with the widespread feelings of resentment toward the professional managerial elite. One example we've seen here in Wisconsin over the past few years is the attack on teachers and higher education in general. My question is, why does the race to the bottom mentality often permeate the working class?
In many ways, that race to the bottom, which the attack on teachers is such a tragic instance of, I fault the class culture gap for that, because certainly the conservative forces that have been very anti-union since the early 20th century have managed to, what they've managed to do in this Wisconsin teacher situation was a classic example. They've managed to tap working class anger at their own economic conditions to attack the livelihoods of other people who are basically working class people. I mean, many, many teachers.
They are, you're right.
Yeah, they are. But progressives' failure to really connect with the white working class is what has opened the door to that kind of race to the bottom. And that's exactly why I think that it's so important to bridge the class culture gap.
We have one line open if you've been trying to reach us, 800-486-8655. Kevin in Crandon, hi.
Greetings from the snowbound Northwoods.
Greetings.
The reason I was prompted to call was the fella that called in a little bit ago about, you know, people ain't got gumption to go to college and so on and so forth. And the gal, she took care of that okay. And also, you know, the whole college is just not realistic. Not everyone is college, you know?
Right.
And also, yes, you're professional, managerial, elite, upper middle class type people. They live in an entirely different world.
I couldn't agree with you more.
They also can be snooty and condescending to people that they don't feel are at their level.
Yeah, they can be. They can be very dismissive and very offensive. You know, in the professional managerial elite, if you have a child with, quote, learning disabilities, you immediately go into high gear, get a lot of extra attention, very expensive. The mother goes around in 14,000 lessons, and to make sure that that kid can thrive. That doesn't happen in the working class. That is not real life. And so, sure, the most utterly brilliant kids can go to Harvard, but how many kids are we talking about?
Not many.
The other point, I think, is that, you know, there should be a lot of honor in blue-collar jobs. I mean, I use toothpaste. Do you use toothpaste? I use sewers. Do you use sewers? You know, I love books about anthropology, but when I have to, you know, I don't know, I won't finish this sentence. When I need a sewer, not a book on anthropology.
Well, you may need to read the book on anthropology, you know, when you're, you know, I mean, why not?
Definitely. I think we should move on.
Yeah, I think so, too. Let's talk about another area that you focus on in your article. An understanding, give us an understanding of the working class resentment of the poor. How deep is the resentment? Where does it come from?
This is something that progressives have, you know, created in significant part. And it's kind of a tragedy. I mean, we live in a country where we don't believe in government. We don't believe in social programs. In order to try to protect the most vulnerable from capitalism red in tooth and claw, we provide these paltry little means-tested social programs like welfare, TANF, and child care subsidies, for example. And so what's the result? Is people just one notch above say, what am I, chopped liver? They're giving money to the poor, and I work just as hard. I work maybe harder, and I'm not getting anything. And so these means-tested programs have fueled a lot of fury on the part of the white working class. The black working class actually is quite different, and this is one of the rare ways in which they're quite different, but a lot of fury against the poor for that reason. Hmm. Also, the white working class, the settled families in the white working class are very proud of the fact that they, through the exercise of unbelievable hard work and rigid self-discipline, they managed, like my father-in-law, to come up into a settled middle-class life. And so they look at the poor and they say, you know, these are hard-living people. They don't have that self-discipline. Now, you know, I studied poverty for 20 years. I don't agree. But that's the way they see it. And then the other thing that progressives have done, which has fed such a poisonous political dynamic, is, again, I'm talking to someone who's worked on diversity issues for 30 years. We talk about diversity and multiculturalism and all the rest of it. How about talking about all of the things the government is doing for Americans? I mean, the famous sign is, get your government hands off my Medicare. And the senator had to explain to the constituent, your Medicare comes from your government. But that has not been a strong message. We don't teach civics. We don't teach what the government does. And I think we have to start doing that. I mean, I've proposed a campaign of, like, people going on YouTube and saying, I just used a sewer. Thank you, government. I just drove on a highway. Thank you, Uncle Sam. I just used a post office. Thank you, Uncle Sam. I mean, there's a wonderful scholar named Suzanne Mettler at Cornell, and she is basically talks about the submerged state. And, you know, more shame on us as progressives that when we've had 30 years, 40 years of very effective anti-government propaganda, we haven't been countering it by saying, these are all the ways, Americans, in which your daily life is improved by the government. We've dropped the ball.
So in order to alleviate the concern that white working class has about programs the poor are getting and they may not be, are they saying, give us a program too, give us child care credits, give us more food stamp availability, or are they saying nobody should have a handout?
They're saying we hate the government. There should be smaller government. That's what they're saying, and that's because that's been the way that this anger against the poor has been channeled very successfully, in a very sustained and craftsmanlike fashion for 40 years, and there's been no effective progressive response.
More phone calls momentarily. Our guest this hour has written a piece that appears in the Harvard Business Review. It's on our Facebook page. Please read it. It's The Kathleen Dunn Show. What so many people don't get about the U.S. working class. Joan Williams is our guest. She is a distinguished professor of law and founding director of the Center of Work-Life Law at the University of California, Hastings College of Law. She's the author of many books, including What Works for Women at Work, Four Patterns Every Woman Should Know. We should talk to her about that down the road. More phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is the number. Leave messages on our Facebook page, too. This conversation is generating a lot of response, and if we can't get to you on the air, we can read what you say on Facebook. This is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go back to phone calls. We go to Lori next in Vernon County. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Thank you so much for this program. There's so much here, and I hope you do more on this. I've been working out here for the last year and a half or so on political campaigns, you know, in a rural county with progressive candidates. What I'd like you to talk about is the prison system. We have here in Wisconsin, as you know, we have, you know, Milwaukee basically is the African American center, and you know, the progressive or the liberals are, you know, they're part of that prison system that are sending people out here to rural areas to be imprisoned, and so we're having these. It just really skews the perception of black people out here to you know, the only people we see are you know, people in prison, right? For a lot of it. And I do, you know, I will go back, you know, 20 years to all the three strikes you're out to that era of defunding the cash assistance as you were talking about, really making a lot of people very desperate in Milwaukee, and we haven't looked at it, we haven't examined that, and yet, you know, they just come out here, and it's really, really messing up our society in so many ways. So thank you for having this program.
Thanks so much for the call, Lori.
I mean, it's fascinating, and I'd never heard anyone mention the phenomenon of putting prisons in rural areas so that the only people of color that some rural whites see are people in prison. I'd never really thought about that as an important dynamic. You know, a lot of people out there are desperate. A lot of people out there are really, really hurting economically. And in my opinion, as someone who's voted Democratic for, 50 years, you know, shame on us. We should have been... in sending a message that connected us to those people, and I think that too often we weren't.
Mm. And you see in your article, Joan, you talk about these vast rural areas in the country, which we're paying no attention to really, are withering away, leaving trails of pain. When did you ever hear any American politician talk about that? Never, you say.
Yeah, I mean, the only time I ever hear about the rural areas is people making fun of farm subsidies. I mean, and, you know, I'm not exactly a policy wonk, but I'm kind of in that world. And so I mean, it's been really the same message of blue-collar people, if you want a decent life, go to college. If you don't, you're just lazy. And rural people, if you want a decent life, move to the big city. And if you don't, well, I guess you just chose to be a rube. These are not really viable long-term messages. I mean, think about the contrast with Germany, where you have a very different discourse about blue-collar work. It's very much more respected. They have a robust industrial policy that has been designed to keep blue-collar jobs in Germany. Now, Germany is very different from the United States, and we can't do it exactly the way that Germany did it, but there's actually a wonderful book called Rework America that I would really recommend to people who want to know what an American industrial policy would look like.
Good. It would
I
be...
also want to mention, Kathleen, before the hour's over,
sure.
that I'm just finishing up this week a book called White Working Class, which will be coming out from Harvard Business Review in mid-May.
Great. So you'll do another show with us.
Indeed, I will.
Thank you. Thanks, Jim. We have time for maybe one or two quick phone calls. Mary in Sun Prairie. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to say that I come from a working class family. My father was a laborer. He probably never made $20,000 in his life. My husband was a policeman, and neither one of them would condone or even think of voting for a man who was as base and as crass as Donald Trump is. We have, it seems we have lowered, I don't know, the political discussion to the point where I'm appalled. And I find it difficult to blame the Democrats because, oh, we did not cater to people who approve of that crassness. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mary. Thanks for the call.
You know, Mary, I'm as shocked as you are. I mean, I'm just absolutely aghast at so many things about Mr. Trump personally and about the crassness of the discussion. I mean, we have a presidential candidate who was elected after boasting about sexually harassing women. It's just who called Mexicans rapists. I don't know, maybe all of them. I don't know. It's really, really shocking. I don't condone it either, but I am trying to understand it, and I'm trying to figure out what I can do to control what I have under my control to change that situation.
And we thank you so much. What an interesting hour it's been, Joan. Thank you very much for writing the article and for being with us.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure, Kathleen. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll talk again. Professor Joan Williams, she's a distinguished professor of law, founding director of the Center of Work-Life Law at the University of California, Hastings College of Law. She has a new book coming out, and White Working Class is the title of it, and we will definitely talk with her again sometime, May, early May, late April, about that book. Also author of What Works for Women at Work, Four Patterns Every Woman Should Know. Her piece in the Harvard Business Review is on our Facebook page, and it is definitely worth reading. It will spark conversation at your dinner table or at work tomorrow or wherever. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks so much to Scotty Myers for producing this hour and to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Thanks for your many calls. They were very good. And thank you always for listening to the Ideas Network. News is coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with an hour you'll want to hear.